Chapter 17. Randall Flagg, the dark man, strode south on U.S. 51, listening to the night sounds that pressed close on both sides of this narrow road that would take him sooner or later out of Idaho and into Nevada. From Nevada, he might go anywhere. It was his country, and none knew or loved it better. He knew where the roads went, and he walked them at night. Now, an hour before dawn, he was somewhere between Grassmere and Riddle, west of Twin Falls, still north of the Duck Valley Reservation that spreads across two states. He walked rapidly, run-down boot heels clocking against the paved surface of the road, and if car lights showed on the horizon, he faded back and back, down over the soft shoulder to the high grass where the night bugs make their homes. And the car would pass him, the driver perhaps feeling a slight chill, as if he had driven through an air pocket, his sleeping wife and children stirring uneasily, as if all had been touched with a bad dream at the same instant. He walked south, south on U.S. 51, the worn heels of his sharp-toed cowboy boots clocking on the pavement. A tall man with no age, in faded, pegged jeans, and a denim jacket. His pockets were stuffed with 50 different kinds of conflicting literature. When this man handed you a tract, you took it no matter what the subject. The dangers of atomic power plants, the role played by the international Jewish cartel in the overthrow of friendly governments, the CIA, the Farm Workers Union, the Jehovah's Witnesses. If you can answer these 10 questions, yes, you have been saved. The Blacks for Militant Equality, the Code of the Klan. He had them all, and more, too. There was a button on each breast of his denim jacket. On the right, a yellow smile face. On the left, a pig wearing a policeman's cap. The legend was written beneath in a sentence. How's your pork? He moved on, not pausing, not slowing, but alive to the night. His eyes seemed almost frantic with the night's possibilities. There was a Boy Scouts of America knapsack on his back, old and battered. There was a dark hilarity in his face, and perhaps in his heart, too, you would think. And you would be right. It was the face of a hatefully happy man, a face that radiated a horrible, handsome warmth, a face to make water glasses shatter in the hands of tired truck stop waitresses, to make small children crash their trikes into board fences and then run wailing to their mommies with stake-shaped splinters sticking out of their knees. It was a face guaranteed to make barroom arguments over batting averages turn bloody. He moved on south, somewhere on U.S. 51 between Grassmere and Riddle, now closer to Nevada. Soon he would camp and sleep the day away, waking up as evening drew on. He would read as his supper cooked over a small, smokeless campfire, it didn't matter what, words from some battered and coverless paperback novel. And after supper he would walk south on this excellent two-lane highway cutting through this godforsaken wilderness, watching and smelling and listening as the climate grew more arid, strangling everything down to sagebrush and tumbleweed, watching as the mountains began to poke out of the earth like dinosaur bones. By dawn tomorrow or the day after that, he would pass into Nevada, striking Owyhee first, and then Mountain City, and in Mountain City there was a man named Christopher Bradenton who would see that he had a clean car. With a car, the country would come alive in all its glorious possibilities. A body politic with its network of roads embedded in its skin like marvelous capillaries, ready to take him, the dark speck of foreign matter, anywhere. He hammered along, arms swinging by his sides. He was known, well known, along the highways in hiding that are traveled by the poor and the mad, by the professional revolutionaries and by those who have been taught to hate so well that their hate shows on their faces like hare lips. They are unwelcome except by others like them, who welcome them to cheap rooms with slogans and posters on the walls, to basements where lengths of sawed-off pipe are held in padded vices while they're stuffed with high explosives, to back rooms where lunatic plans are laid, to kill a cabinet member, to kidnap the child of a visiting dignitary, or to break into a boardroom meeting of Standard Oil with grenades and machine guns and murder in the name of the people. He was known there, and even the maddest of them could only look at his dark and grinning face at an oblique angle. The women he took to bed with him, even if they had reduced intercourse to something as casual as getting a snack from the refrigerator, accepted him with a stiffening of the body, a turning away of the countenance. Sometimes they accepted him with tears. They took him the way they might take a ram with golden eyes or a black dog. And when it was done, they were cold. So cold, it seemed impossible they could ever be warm again. When he walked into a meeting, the hysterical babble ceased. The backbiting, recriminations, accusations, the ideological rhetoric. For a moment there would be dead silence, and they would start to turn to him, and then turn away, as if he had come to them with some old and terrible engine of destruction cradled in his arms, something 1,000 times worse than the plastic explosive made in the basement labs of renegade chemistry students, or the black market arms obtained from some greedy army post supply sergeant. It seemed that he had come to them with a device gone rusty with blood and packed for centuries in the cosmoline of screams, but now ready again, carried to their meeting like some infernal gift, a birthday cake with nitroglycerin candles. And when the talk began again, it would be rational and disciplined as madmen can make it, and things would be agreed upon. He rocked along, his feet easy in the boots, which were comfortably sprung in all the right places. His feet and these boots were old lovers. Christopher Bradenton in Mountain City knew him as Richard Fry. Bradenton was a conductor on one of the underground railway systems by which fugitives moved. Half a dozen different organizations, from the Weathermen to the Guevara Brigade, saw that Bradenton had money. He was a poet who sometimes taught free university classes or traveled in the western states of Utah, Nevada, and Arizona, speaking to high school English classes, stunning middle-class boys and girls, he hoped, with the news that poetry was an unquiet corpse. He was in his 40s now, but Bradenton had been dismissed from one California college 15 years ago for getting too chummy with the SDS. He had been busted in the Great Chicago Pig Convention of 1968, formed his ties to one radical group after another, first embracing the craziness of these groups, then being swallowed whole. The dark man walked and smiled. Bradenton represented just one end of one conduit, and there were thousands of them. The pipes the crazies moved through, carrying their books and bombs. The pipes were interconnected, the signposts disguised but readable to the initiate. In New York, he was known as Robert Frank, and his claim that he was a black man had never been disputed, although his skin was very light. He and a black veteran of Nam, the black vet had more than enough hate to make up for his missing left leg, had offed 6 cops in New York and New Jersey. In Georgia, he was Ramsey Forrest, a distant descendant of Nathan Bedford Forrest, and in his white sheet he had participated in 2 rapes, a castration, and the burning of a nigger shanty town. But that had been long ago, in the early 60s, during the first civil rights surge. He sometimes thought that he might have been born in that strife. He certainly could not remember much that had happened to him before that, except that he came originally from Nebraska, and that he had once attended high school classes with a red-haired, bandy-legged boy named Charles Starkweather. He remembered the civil rights marches of 1960 and 61 better, the beatings, the night rides, the churches that had exploded as if some miracle inside them had grown too big to be contained. He remembered drifting down to New Orleans in 1962 and meeting a demented young man who was handing out tracts urging America to leave Cuba alone. That man had been a certain Mr. Oswald, and he had taken some of Oswald's tracts, and he still had a couple, very old and crumpled, in one of his many pockets. He had sat on 100 different committees of responsibility. He had walked in demonstrations against the same dozen companies on 100 different college campuses. He wrote the questions that most discomfited those in power when they came to lecture, but he never asked the questions himself because they might have seen his grinning, burning face as some cause for alarm and fled from the podium. Likewise, he never spoke at rallies because the microphones would scream with hysterical feedback and circuits would blow. But he had written speeches for those who did speak, and on several occasions those speeches had ended in riots, overturned cars, student strike votes, and violent demonstrations. For a while in the early 70s, he had been acquainted with a man named Donald DeFries, and had suggested that DeFries take the name Sank. He had helped lay plans that resulted in the kidnapping of an heiress, and it had been he who suggested that the heiress be made crazy instead of ransomed. He had left the small Los Angeles house where DeFries and the others had fried not 20 minutes before the police had arrived. He slunk away up the street, his bulging and dusty boots clocking on the pavement, a fiery grin on his face that made mothers grab up their children and pull them into the house. And later, when a few tattered remnants of the group were swept up, all they knew was that there had been someone else associated with the group, maybe someone important, maybe just a hanger-on, a man of no age, a man who was sometimes called the walkin' dude. He strode on at a steady, ground-eating pace. 2 days ago, he had been in Laramie, Wyoming, part of an Ekatage group that had blown a power station. Today, he was on U.S. 51, between Grassmere and Riddle, on his way to Mountain City. Tomorrow, he would be somewhere else. And he was happier than he had ever been, because he stopped. Because something was coming. He could feel it, almost taste it on the night air. He could taste it, a sooty hot taste that came from everywhere, as if God was planning a cookout and all of civilization was going to be the barbecue. His time of transfiguration was at hand. He was going to be born for the second time. He was going to be squeezed out of the laboring cunt of some great sand-colored beast that even now lay in the throes of its contractions, its legs moving slowly as the birth blood gushed, its sun-hot eyes glaring into the emptiness. He had been born when times changed, and the times were going to change again. It was in the wind of this soft Idaho evening. It was almost time to be reborn. He knew. Why else could he suddenly do magic?